Hello, everyone, and welcome to College and Career Readiness Radio. I'm your host, Dr. TJ Varey. College and Career Readiness Radio is a podcast that brings together thought leaders from around the world to discuss the implementation of innovative strategies to support college and career readiness for students from early childhood to post-secondary success. I want to thank you for tuning in as listeners, and I'm excited to share this episode with you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to College and Career Readiness Radio. I'm your host, TJ Varey, and I'm thrilled to be talking today with our guest, Jason Van Nuss. Jason, thanks for joining me on the show.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here, TJ.
Today, we're connecting the dots between a quality work-based learning program on a continuum from elementary to high school and college and career readiness for students worldwide. I couldn't think of a more expert guest to talk about this topic than Jason. Let me tell you just a little bit more about him. Jason is a work-based learning and youth apprenticeship director. He's passionate about working with students, employers, and industry toward robust workforce and economic development. He's a thought leader in the career and technical education space, and he's known as a gentle disruptor and talent pipeline specialist, which I have questions about, Jason, so we're going to get into that.
Let's do it.
I recently saw you present at the ACTE Work-Based Learning Conference, which was a blast, and I'm going to do another shout-out, which I do often on this show, to ACTE and their resources for folks like us who are in the work-based learning space. So check that out in the show notes. I'll give a link to ACTE. You were at the conference in Washington, and you presented on a number of concepts. The one that I gravitated towards was your three E's of work-based learning and how that exists on a continuum for kids. Can you describe that to the listeners and give a little bit more detail for our audience?
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually a standalone presentation, but I embedded it in the apprenticeship and AI was the session that one was in. And we were talking about, you know, how to serve your students using AI. And then I broke it down into the three E's. And so the way I kind of break this down in my mind is, so I don't mean continuum in like this, like really official, like professional development stance. I mean continuum in just like sequence, almost like a sequencing and a scope and sequencing of work-based learning. So I use the three E's are exposure, exploration, and experience. And they break down by grade level for me. So exposure is work-based learning, basically making the case that work-based learning should be taught throughout K-12 education. And when you're in K through five, you're focusing more on just exposing them to different careers, giving them options to go in and learn about all that's out there. And then you're coming in grades 6 through 9, before they're 16 and can go out and work, you're focusing on, now you're letting them explore all the careers they were exposed to, and you were letting them come in and begin to explore them, build out those interest profiles and see what they're interested in. And then the last E, which is experience, is reserved in my mind, at least for 10, 11, and 12th graders. And that's when they can actually leave school and go to work in a program like mine, work-based learning program. And so by the time they've been exposed to this, like a very wide breadth of careers in the exposure realm, and then they've narrowed it down to really exploring the careers that they're interested in and may have a skill set for in the middle school areas, pretty much 6 through 9, that by the time they get 10th grade, they should be able to have a pretty good idea of where they want to go actually experience the job site. And that's in 10, 11, and 12th grade. So those are the way I break it down in my mind are the three E's. And it's just a really unique way of trying to convince people to broaden the scope and sequence of work-based learning education. It's not just for kids who can leave and go to work. As a matter of fact, I mean, you know, one of our counterparts, Christy Valesky, makes a pretty articulate argument that is a lot of programs that just view work-based learning as going to work, and it's not. Like, they need to be exposed to these careers, explore these careers, and then go out and experience the ones that they're the most interested and or skilled for. So that's the idea behind it.
That's a great description of it. And Christy's been on the show. We talked about work-based learning when she was a guest as well. It's a huge topic right now. I'm wondering about what happens when we have some stumbling blocks along the way, because that's the reason I gravitated towards your three E's, because we see a lot of work being done in high schools, even some mandates, policies, and so forth, state by state, that kids need some experiences in high schools. And then, you know, they end up working at a gas station or something, for example, and we count that. And like you said, and like Christy said, that's not really work-based learning. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about like getting that into middle and elementary schools? Because that's just not typically where we're thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and real quick to speak on that, in Georgia, we have a unique category system for work-based learning. We have our youth apprenticeship, which is the highest level, which means that the student's job placement aligns with what they studied in high school, their CTE area, and what they want to do for a career. So almost that triangle, all three things are filled in that triangle, where they're working in high school, what they're studying in high school, and what they want to do as a career afterwards. When none of those triangles match, let's just say you got a student in automotive who is working at, you know, Belk's folding t-shirts, right? They're not getting any skills that are going to benefit them in what they're studying in the automotive area, except employability skill development, ESD. And that's our lowest category in Georgia. So if there is a student who, let's say I want to put them in an automotive, a welding fabrication place or a garage where they're working on cars, but that job's not available yet, then I can put them in a holding place, an ESD placement, which means that they're not learning any technical skills that are going to facilitate what they're doing in the CTE lab or what they want to do for a career, but they are learning those employability skills like showing up to work on time, wearing a clean uniform, customer service, that so those basic employability skills. And I think you and I have a really unique way. We have an understanding of trying to kill the term soft skills. And I know that we both hate that term. So we call them employability skills in Georgia. So there is a value there. But the problem is when, you know, that should be like 10, 15, maybe 20% of your program at the most. The other students should have those really high-end aligned placements with what they're doing, and that coordinates with what they are studying in the high school laboratory, the CT laboratories, and what they want to do afterwards. So I just want to clarify that. One sign of fruit of that, TJ, is on their application for their program is, do you already have a job? If that's a question on your work-based learning application, you're really building yourself up for failure, because that should be the work-based learning coordinator's job, is to find jobs that align with their what they're studying. If you're requiring them to have a job to come into your program, then yeah, you're going to have a lot of people say, yeah, I work at Taco Bell. Yeah, I'm working over here at JCPenney's. I'm working at this storage place. And there's no direct correlation to what they're studying. So that may be a pretty simple way to fix that solution. And now I've already forgotten what the question was. I'm sorry.
That's fine. That was a great answer to a question I didn't ask. But it's a good way to think about work-based learning. I'm glad you brought it up. My question is, how do we get people to think about that in middle and elementary school? Oh, because much of the focus of work-based learning is on high school, even the dollars that are tied to it. And I know there are listeners who already have work-based learning programs, and they're like, well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, but they want to get it into middle and elementary. And there's others listening now who say, work-based learning coordinator, youth apprenticeship director, how do we even get people like that to work at our schools? So talk to us about what you're seeing in elementary and middle school and how to get it down into those grade levels.
Well, it's slow going. I can say that. It's slow going. So it's broadening the perspective of what people think work-based learning is. And so I say this, anytime you bring a new product to market, and I say this on pretty much every podcast I'm a part of, the biggest obstacle is education, right? You have to be able to talk to people about why what you're doing is better than what's already being done. You know, if you're selling new toothbrushes, hey, this is why my new toothbrush is better than the one you already have. So that's the first step in doing this, is telling people, hey, look, if you're just focusing on experience at the high school level, that final E, how do you know the student is making an educated decision on what they want to experience if they haven't been exposed to all the careers available in your area? How do you know that once they've been exposed to all those careers, that they may go in the middle school area and explore those careers? But how do you know that if you don't have the exposure and exploration part, you can't have any confidence in the experience part? Because it might be my job. They may say, well, I want to be an accountant, right? Well, if they haven't studied accounting, they were exposed to being an accountant. They went and they did some exploring in the accounting area, and then I placed them. That's great. But what if they didn't do the exploration part, and they didn't realize that as an accountant, your career is tied to tax season, and so for 4 months you're not going to really see your family, right? But when I put them in a placement in a tax office, I'm going to put them there in tax season so they can see what it's really like. Another example of this is I had a young lady who came and she wanted to be a large animal vet because she loved animals. Now that sounds like a great fit, right? But when would that be a bad fit, TJ? Large animal vets don't just save animals. Sometimes they have to put them down. And I put her with a large animal vet and she had to put down a horse and it broke her heart. And she was like, Mr. V, I can't do this. I love animals, but I can't do this. And so she switched and went and did something else for a career. And so those are all examples of what we know as experience, right? But had she done and this is when my program first started, so I didn't have that exposure or exploration part built in. And it's still not great. I'm still doing it because it requires a lot of other partners. But had we had the exploration part of that, she would have gone in and seen, hey, there's a big part of this job, which is dealing with animals that have been abused, which is putting animals down because they're not healthy. And she would have been like, I don't know if I could do that. And it would have saved. Now, luckily, still work-based learning is an environment where they're getting to experience something without having to put in $100,000 of student debt, right? Or to accrue that. So it's still a victory because she found out before she went to school to be a vet. But that could have been quelled prior had we had a built-in exploration part of that.
I like that you're talking about what students don't want to do as much as what they do want to pursue. I think that's a really important point, is that work-based learning should help steer students Absolutely. In a direction. It could solidify things, yeah. But it could also teach them the things that they don't want to do. And like you said, that saves time, money, energy, all spent going in a wrong direction.
Not just for the student, but the industry. Because if I take on a student or a recent graduate, it happens a lot in nursing. My wife used to advise when we were newlyweds and just recently graduated college, and she went and was doing some advising for nursing students. She said there's a lot of people who would come to her after taking all their courses, and then they finally get into the placement, like, well, I can't do this. And well, you've got 2 years under your belt of instruction before you've actually gotten in there, and I'd have to change their whole program of course of study. So that's not just a valuable thing for the student to conserve or be more efficient with their resources, but also for employers. Because can you imagine hiring somebody, investing in them, training them, getting everything started, and then them be on the job for a couple of months and say, I don't want to do this. Now it's cost the employer money and time, and put them behind the eight ball because they chose that employer over other, or that employee over other employees. And now the other employees are now gone. So now they got to start from scratch again. So this is a comprehensive solution to workforce development in not just within a school and in you know, local workforce, but within the community at large. If everyone adapts and moves this direction, you're going to have you're going to establish proof of concept quicker with the value of work-based learning than you would if you didn't have the first two E's, exposure and exploration.
Great point about the industry partner and the benefit to them. Let's talk about industry partners. Huge question mark for a lot of people who are starting work-based learning is, how do I get the industry partners on board? You just made a great case for one of the reasons why they should get on board. Can you talk to us about how you approach industry partners and how you approach the concept of bringing industry partners into the fold?
If I could boil it down, TJ, I would say that the number one way I recruit business partners is by showing them value. Okay. Now you said, Jason, that's a really broad answer. And I know it's a broad answer. And I have 7 or 8 points under that on how you show them value. But the biggest mistake that that coordinators or CT directors or principals or superintendents make when they're trying to recruit business partners is they are selling the idea of altruism or philanthropy. Hey, help the students because they need your help. And I'm not saying that's a terrible way to recruit that, but I'm saying there's going to be a lot of breakage. When you recruit with the with that philanthropic or altruistic mindset, you're going to get a lot of people who jump on board, but you're going to have a lot of breakage when you have an event or you need to ask for your business partners to do something, and on their calendar, it comes in contact with a for-profit event. They're going to say, oh, I can't do that. You're going to get a lot of regrets, and there's going to be a lot of breakage, not a lot of follow-through, in other words. But when you start pitching the idea that these students are really going to affect their bottom line, that you're giving them access to talent earlier, that they're going to be able to retain that talent, vet and retain that talent. So if the student's not going to cut it, then they can cut them loose and leave that student who's not good enough for them, let that student be hired by their competitors. That's a pretty unique advantage competitively, right? Hiring. But anyway, I give them access to talent. They vet that talent through working and internships and apprenticeships. And then when they can hire that student long-term after graduation, once they've done those three things, again, access to talent, they've retained that talent, those two things equal a talent pipeline. And so that's how I go in and communicate value to them, is say, look, I'm giving you a competitive advantage over everybody else in your industry who's trying to hire the same students. They're all looking to hire post-secondary students or graduates. I'm giving you access to those students they're going to hire, but 2 to 3 years earlier. So by the time your competitors even know who they are, they've been with you for 2 or 3 years, gotten one or two raises, they've been onboarded. If they require any post-secondary education, you can send them off to that education as an employee of your company. There is a loyalty from a high school student to their employer when they hired them and worked with them 16, 17, 18 years old that they don't. Often I'm seeing a lot of my students are not jumping for a quarter or 50 cent an hour raise, because they have relationships, they've been on board, they already have a place in that culture. And so that's something I try to talk to my students about, the ones who go in those placements. But that's how I do it, is I talk about value. So stop pitching philanthropy, start pitching value, start pitching return on investment. I like to try to kill educational alphabet soup language. Stop speaking, like military and educations are really, they're really bad about speaking in these three-letter acronyms, right? Like, get rid of those, start speaking on the only three-letter acronym that really matters in industry, and it's return on investment. If you're going to hire a high school student, what's in it for you? And when I started pitching it that way, I started seeing a lot of people, a lot more responsive. I don't know if we have time. Do I have time to tell you like my go-to pitch for people?
100%. Let's hear it. I mean, I think if it's something that listeners can use, I really like the return on investment. I've heard here a number of times on this show that philanthropy is only the beginning, that people want to know what stake they have in the game and what they're going to get through the relationship. So yeah, let's hear the pitch.
So the way that I like to, and this is not my first pitch, but this is typically when I've talked with them and they're kind of on the fence, I'll go in and some variety. And again, you know, you need to finesse this, but I'm going to be blunt for the show, but you have to really kind of finesse it. But you go in and you say, hey, look, your company's tax dollars are going into our local government. They're being sent back to the state. The state's sending it back to us, and it's finding its way into our school system. So however you want to track that, that's fine. But basically, the bottom line is your tax dollars are finding their way into the school system, and you're paying us to develop talent. So if in that scenario, you don't have an active strategy to hire students while they're in high school, you're forfeiting a return on that investment. And worse than that, you're paying us to develop talent that your competitors are going to hire. So let me just save you the time and go ahead and write your competitors a check and let them put it in the in their, you know, labor acquisition budget. Like, would you write your competitors a check from your, you know, accounts? No, you wouldn't do that. But that's what you're doing when your taxes are building up resources in your local school systems. And I don't want to be rude. I don't want to be insensitive. I'm not strictly referring to students as assets, but in the workforce development area and economic development area, they are assets. And our tax dollars are coming to our schools, and we're building this talent, and school and employers aren't actively trying to hire those students. So when they're doing that, they're just writing off that expense, because it's a sunken cost. You can't do anything about it, right? It's a sunken cost. They're writing that expense off. We're not going to get a return on that. And then the other end is that talent still being developed through our local CTE programs. So someone's going to hire those kids. So if it's not you, it's going to be the people who are you're competing against in the workforce. So education is the only entity that I know that spends 12 years developing an asset only to let it walk right when it becomes returnable. Think about that. That's crazy. No other company in the world would be able. Their stakeholders or shareholders would be furious. Their boards would be fired if they invested in an asset for 12 years and then said, "Oh, you're finally going to be returnable. You just go wherever you want to go." I'm not saying trap kids, but I'm saying there needs to be a strategy to retain those kids, because education is really bad about building this talent, and then not trying to retain that talent local so that it becomes a returnable investment in our economy through taxes, through, you know, paying for childcare and living and mortgages and bills and eating out and adding to the quality of life, which we know now is one of the main factors for students who we're investing in. They're looking for quality of life before they look for jobs, right? Well, if we don't stop retaining that talent and retaining young workers, they're going to continue to leave because they're not going to see any quality of life improvements. They're not going to see any things that they want to do. Because so it's a snowball, but the bottom line is it's the return on investment. If you don't have a strategy to hire high school students, you're paying me to develop talent for your competitors to hire, and that makes no sense from a business expense standpoint.
And I would also say it's kind of on a whim, right? Even if you're not developing talent for your competitors, you're not involved in the talent development that you're paying for. I love that pitch. Yes. Anybody can use it. So listeners, that's a pitch that Jason uses. You can use it too, especially those of you who are trying to build your bank of industry partners.
Yep.
And again, super cool pitch. Jason, I also think about involving the industry partners in the curriculum, whether that be CTE or you said we don't like soft skills. I call them durable skills or transferable skills.
I've had some
folks on the show talk about that, including Mitch Weathers, who talks a lot about executive functioning, things that kids need for college and career readiness. I wonder how you maybe involve, if you could give us some tips or tricks to involve the industry partners in the actual curriculum.
Absolutely.
Again, whether that's CTE or some other type of advisory that schools are running.
I can give you two examples. One, advisory boards. When you collect data, so we haven't gotten into data, that's a whole other thing, but I'm a big person on collecting data. That's how I can recruit partners, is I can give them the average wage, the average earnings, the total economic development or estimated economic development. Like last year, we were almost a little over $8 million of economic development in my community. Raw wages earned were, you know, almost $2 million. And then estimated economic development from just my students alone. So that's just the data, right? So you have that data, and then you begin to recruit people to sit on your advisory board. And you do that by going to your mayor and saying, "Hey, look, my students are generating this amount of money in our local economy every single semester. I'm an educator. I need you to sit on my advisory board, because I need your expertise in how to steer this economic engine for for our community in the best way." And then you do that with the county commissioner, and you do that with the county manager, and you do that with the chamber of commerce person, and you do that with the development authority. And you get all these, what I call alphas, on your advisory board. And then once they're in the, you give them the reason to come. And then when they come to your advisory board, you make the meetings count. You don't do silly things. You get in there, you give them lunch. You do it during a time where they're going to take a break from work anyway. So you give them lunch. You have a meeting, you have a purpose, you have an assignment, you get their feedback, and then you start sharing and they see what's happening in your program. And then everybody I just mentioned to you have at one time or another all been, if not continually are, employers of my students, because they sat on my advisory board, they saw my mission, my vision, they saw my passion, they saw what was happening in our community just by sitting on the advisory board, and then they became employers. So that's one way you get them here. But how do I get them involved in the curriculum? The most effective way is those advisory boards. As I say, look, I can teach whatever I need to teach. I need you to tell me, what is it that needs to be taught? What are you seeing in this age student that's where they're deficient? Is it communication skills? Is it staying off their phone? Is it showing up to work on time? I mean, what is it? Like, and then I let them drive my curriculum. That gets them involved. I call mine a board of directors, because I want to tell them, even in the name, I'm letting you direct my program. You are that important. You direct my program. And again, that's just semantics. I think when you talk about advisory boards are great, but it's passive. I'm saying, look, TJ, I'm going to let you advise me And then I may or may not take your advice, you know? But if I say, no, TJ, like, you're important. You are an alpha in our community. I need you to sit on my board of directors. And the consensus of this board is where I'll take my program. That gives them a lot more reason to sit on there. So having them involved in the curriculum in terms of how it's being developed. But another way, and another really unique thing that I've seen happen, is a program that I created 3 years ago called the Reverse Career Fair. And it's where students spend an entire semester learning how to sell their skills, right? And so if you think about a regular career fair, it's the employers around the room with their banners and swag and flashing lights and squeegee balls and stress balls and candy. And they're trying to convince students to come meet them. And the students in there have been taught how to engage people. And so there's no engagement. No party has a good time there. So I flip the roles, and my students spend the whole semester with scaffolding assignments, learning how to sell their skills, learning how to build their booth. They outline the room, and then I release the employers into the room. They go meet the students. The students have to defend themselves, answer questions, build their skills, sell their skills. That's a really good way I've gotten my industry involved in the curriculum. And a really unique way to say that is, I just did this in May. I'm on the block. I do it at the end of each semester. The last one I did in the spring, I had an industry partner. I think it was our mayor was talking to this young lady who was an architect. She wanted to be an architect student. And he called somebody who I didn't know and was like, hey, I need you to come down to their conference center and meet this young lady. She's legit. And so this guy I didn't even know was called by my mayor, who was there talking with the kids, forcing them to sell their skills, defend their skill sets, build this, have conversations, look people in the eye. He was so impressed, he called a friend of his who owns a small architecture firm and said, get down here. They're going to be open for another 45 minutes. You need to come meet this young lady. And so he sold the program to another industry partner. So having that is really unique way to bring them in, because you're not asking them to come in and do anything other than just talk to people. And then when they leave the student's booth, they scan a QR code, they give feedback on that student, and the feedback's anonymous. So there's no risk of, because I have a lot of elected officials who come to that event. I don't want anybody losing votes because they were honest, but there's someone's baby or someone's kid. So the feedback's anonymous, but the students get feedback immediately on, hey, look, you really did a good job of convening your skill sets, but you didn't look me in the eye. That would be a red flag for me in an interview. Or, hey, you were really personable, but you didn't talk at all about your skill set as a marketing exec. You want to be a marketing executive. You didn't mention that at all. Just getting that feedback from the students, that does your message match your booth? That's how getting students in the industry or industry into the curriculum is two ways. Have them help build it on the board of directors side, and then have them participate in the back end where they're actually coming in and meeting the kids and seeing the fruit and seeing the talent that's coming out of these programs. That's been very successful, wildly successful for me.
There's a lot of strategy in there for sure. One thing I'd like to underscore, really two things, is getting the powers that be involved. Higher up you can go, whether it's a commissioner or a director of the Chamber of Commerce, whoever is the highest level is always going to be a good connection. And then the other thing that I want to highlight is just the network effect. I talk about this a lot. And what that mayor did with that student was just expanded her network. 100%. And expand it to a network that she didn't have, yep. And maybe even an architecture firm that she never would have known about. And that is a great strategy for talent pipeline, but also expanding students'
and
networks.
I call that
is
social
critical.
Capital. So I call that a social capital event, because I'm giving these young students access to the most important people in our community. And I was like, look, it's up to you. If you don't do a good job, they're not going to be a part of your network, and you can't rely on them to further your career. But if you do a good job, you impress them, and you connect with them on LinkedIn, you send them a follow-up email, you write them a follow-up thank you card, and then in 2 or 3 years, you can reach back out and say, hey, look, we met at this meeting 3 years ago at Reverse Career Fair. We had talked to you then about my prospects as a future architect. I'm looking for an apprenticeship now in college. Do you have any local firms you could hook me up with? That's social capital. And these kids, especially the kids who are at risk, who don't have the doctors or the parents who are doctors or lawyers or the people who come into my program who have zero social capital because they're below the poverty line, they're disenfranchised or disadvantaged in a number of different areas. That event is a massive mover of the needle for them because they're not adding to their network. They're establishing the epistemology of that network. That social capital is more important for them than the affluent student whose parents are both surgeons or lawyers. And so that's kind of what that program is. It's field leveling, but I can't do it without industry involved. Industry has to be involved because if I just did it with teachers, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. The kids aren't going to treat it the same way because they know the teachers. They need to be nervous. They need to know that the people coming are the ones who make the laws for our city, the ones who help clean up from hurricanes, the ones who affect school change, the ones who are putting money into our economy. They need to know that these are the people who move the needle in our community, and they need to be nervous. They need to have some anxiety, some good anxiety, that eustress, not that distress. And they need to be able to push through, to network, to sell their skills. And none of the kids like that event. Before they do it, they are like, we don't like this at all. But on after the event, on the exit survey, it's like 97% of the kids said, I am so glad you made me do this. It was fun, but now I feel more prepared. 100% of the kids said they feel more prepared. Even the ones who didn't like it, they feel more prepared to go to a networking event or a job interview because now they know what to expect. So those types of things to me are just, it's what we're, you can do that at the middle school level. Under exploration. Now you could have a reverse career fair. It's not as detailed as the one I do at the middle school level, just for exploration, where you have the alphas walk around the room. You know, but that's the stuff that these kids need. They need opportunities to engage and to learn and not just say, oh, well, my dad was a lawyer, so I'm gonna do that. You know?
Well, there you have it, reverse career fair. That's something that can be a takeaway for those to build those types of experiences, again, all living under what Jason's described as the three E's. It could be done in elementary, middle, or high school. Jason, as we wrap up here, I'd like to ask this question. If you were going to send a message to admissions officers, counselors, people in your position, work-based learning, industry partners, if you wanted to send one message about these concepts that we've been talking about today,
yeah,
and you had a platform to do it like College and Career Readiness Radio, what would you say that final message, that final call to action is for our audience?
I would boil it down to this. We need to destroy the one-size-fits-all approach to post-secondary counseling. We got to destroy it. I'm not anti-academic. TJ, you know, I'm working on my PhD. I love academics, but that was the right path for me. We need to destroy this one-size-fits-all approach and bring back it. And it doesn't have to be a dichotomy. I would even say this. I would argue that people are trying to destroy the one-size-fits-all. They end up making a dichotomy and saying it's college or career. Why does it have to be an either or, not a both and system? It should be a both and system. And you and I heard a phenomenal speaker at that conference in Seattle, our keynote speaker. Man, that guy blew my mind. Was it Neesmith? Chris Neat was his name. Man, he was legit. Like, that guy was awesome because he had developed a school system that was a both and. It was, hey, look, you can take AP stats and AP physics and AP whatever, but you can also take engineering and you can go be an engineer, which requires college, or you can be a draftsman, which requires no college. Like, that's a both and. Let the kids decide what's best for them. And not push kids in one direction or the other. And I think, I don't know, other than him, and I'm sure that happened, but he's the only one I've ever met who's actually established a both and. You can be both academic and career tech and not an either or. And that would, let's get rid of that. That one size fits all, it's gone. Either or, it's gone. Let's build an inclusive both and. The kid can take academics and elective courses, career courses, and build the pathway that's best suited for them.
It's a great message. And yes, Chris Neesmith, he was an awesome speaker at ACTE Work-Based Learning Conference where Jason and I both were, where we both spoke. And Chris was on the show too, Jason. So he's got an episode on the show that he describes a lot of those a lot of those functions from his school district. This has been fun. It's been real. You're right that we do not want to build a binary system that it is college and career readiness. This has been a delight for me. You heard it here on College and Career Readiness Radio with our guest, Jason Van Nuys. Jason, thanks so much for joining me on the show.
Man, thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
College and Career Readiness Radio is brought to you by Maya Learning. Students of all ages worldwide use Maya Learning to plan their futures. They take assessments, they explore recommended careers, they build academic college and career plans. They create digital profiles and portfolios to tell their stories to potential colleges and industry partners. They post badges and credentials. They can log their work-based learning hours for verification. They experience an interactive social and emotional learning curriculum. Maya Learning helps students with their college essays. It prepares them for SAT and ACT tests, and it tracks all of this to support data management for schools and districts. Counselors use Maya Learning to handle assignments, manage college applications, submit documents through Common App and Parchment, schedule college visits, communicate with students and families, and track results. This means that counselors can focus on students while Maya Learning handles the rest of the administrative work. Maya Learning offers a gamified college and career platform for elementary students to begin exploring their career interests as early as kindergarten. Finally, Maya Offers is a tool for college admissions counselors to view students' digital profiles right in the platform and make offers and generate leads for future students to attend their college or university. If you want to talk more about Maya Learning, you can book a time with me to discuss all the features or just chat about school leadership and college and career readiness. Use the link in the show notes to set up a time that works for you. You can also go to mayalearning.com to learn more. That's mayalearning.com and subscribe to the podcast there. One more time, mayalearning.com.